Gemeinnützige Hertie-Stiftung. Interview.
Was heißt es, in diesen Zeiten Mensch zu sein? Der Mensch ist Teil der Natur und doch scheint es manchmal so, als wären uns unsere Smartphones näher als Tiere oder die Pflanzenwelt. Kann eine Maschine einen Menschen wirklich ersetzen und kann man wiederum einem Roboter Verantwortung übertragen? Das sind Fragen, mit denen ich mich im Vorfeld dieses Podcasts beschäftigt habe. Mein Name ist Mona Mann und ich habe mit KI-Forscherin Joanna Bryson von der Hertie School über künstliche Intelligenz und das Verständnis davon in Gesellschaft und Wissenschaft gesprochen. Welche Rolle spielen Polarisierung, ethische Standards und auch Regulierungen von Seiten internationaler Bündnisse wie der EU? Wie leben wir im Jahr 2040 mit künstlicher Intelligenz und was bedeutet das zum Beispiel für unsere Arbeitswelt? All diese Fragen und Themenfelder hören Sie in dieser Podcast-Episode. Und das Gespräch haben wir auf Englisch geführt. Welcome, Professor Joanna Bryson.
Well, thank you. I'm very glad to be here. It's been fantastic coming to Hertie.
You're a professor of AI, but also holding so many other degrees from technical behavioral science to psychology. But do you remember when you first came into contact to AI?
Ah, that's a really hard question. I was going to say it was because when my mom used to go out one night a week with her friends, then my dad and I watched Star Trek. But I remember even before that, when I was a really little kid, I had a very favorite show called Rough and Ready, and I managed to see this on YouTube, and I had vaguely remembered this, but there was a whole thing about robots and AI and going to Mars. So that must have been my first thing. It would have been 4 or 5, and to see that, and it's everything we're talking about now. I mean, it's little kids' show. But how can you tell if your friend is a robot? Does the robot feel anything? And are robots a problem? Is there really a person inside the robot? It was really interesting that they're introducing that to children in the 60s. So
yeah, that's really early. And it's also fascinating for children. You can learn how to trust or to mistrust the technology or human being. Do you still watch AI movies?
I used to when we still flew. But it's not something I do at home that much. But yeah, no, maybe you meant the first time I really worked directly with AI. And that's a complicated question, too, because then you have to start thinking about what is the definition of AI.
And that's now my cue to ask that what we want to talk about is your definition of AI.
Yeah, this is great. I have a very simple definition, and it's really useful also for regulation. So I, as you mentioned, my first degree was actually, technically, it was behavioral science. So at University of Chicago. So it was sort of the scientific foundations of psychology, including looking at animals. And so when we were trying to understand whether an animal is intelligent or not, we said, well, can it do the appropriate thing when the context changes? So I take from that definition of intelligence, which actually goes back to the 19th century when we were first studying animals. It's a form of computation. You're taking information about the context, and then you're producing action as a consequence of that, right? And the better you can do that, the more you can adjust to the context, and come up with appropriate action, the more intelligent we say you are. So this is a great definition because it really allows very simple things to be a little intelligent. So like plants grow towards the light, or a thermostat turns the heat on when it's time. And I think that's why it's important for regulation, that you realize that there's not some magic point when you suddenly have AI.
And what about the point of artificience in your definition?
Yeah, it's intelligence that someone built. So that's the difference. It's an artifact. That's what the A in AI is. Of all the intelligent things, most of them are natural, but some of them are things that people designed, and that's the AI. So if you think I just made a very clear definition of intelligence, and you could say one of the things that science is about is trying to achieve that kind of clarity. But the word intelligence, as it evolved, and of course it wasn't English, it sort of co-evolves. We think of humans as very intelligent, adult humans as very intelligent. Well, adult humans are also conscious. They're also responsible. They're literally, that's like the innovation of the term of responsibility. It's about adult humans.
Yeah.
And so all these things are associated in people's minds. So when people tend to think that if something were really intelligent, it would be a person. And it's ridiculous. It's like saying if something was really tall, it would be a giraffe. It's like, no, you know. But that's just our default intuition. And it takes discipline to get around recognizing when your intuitions, what is behind your intuitions, and do you want to hold on to that or not? And I would say, no, let's use different words for those things. But like, to the extent a plant is intelligent, a thermostat is AI. But to the extent that that we argue and we use our reason, then sort of old school programming, that if you set it up to kind of do that reasoning, that's a kind of AI. But the stuff that everybody's excited about right now is much more like implicit knowledge. It's much more about like the unconscious. It's actually in some ways like evolution, the body you just came in with. You don't get to choose it.
Yes, the big questions about unconsciousness. I have to admit, I count myself among them too. But how does it come that you were one of the founding members of the Digital Center for Governance? And that's what we wanted to talk about as well. Is digital governance changing our world?
The Hardy Foundation provided funding for another professor to help found. And so that's how I came in. I am one of the pedestals of it, but I was not someone who planned the need for the pedestals. Anyway, so this is digital governance definitely is changing the world, and or not the digital era, the technology that is allowing humans to talk to each other so effectively, that allows us to perfectly replicate our property and to move it around at very low cost, not zero, it's not free, but at relatively low cost. This is changing what it means to govern.
So let's talk about politics. You came from an AI department to work here at Harry School, and you get really quickly asked to be part of the Global Partnership for AI, the so-called GPAI, which is a new transnational initiative originally set up out of the G7, but it has a lot more than seven partners. What was your first thought, and how is it working, this initiative?
I found it a weird choice. Why should the G7 be the ones who solve initially, personally? So I'm not sure if I would have taken the time to do it, except I was so flattered. I'd only been in Germany for 5 months, and I thought, well, I can't turn down the German government. So I was happy to buy that. But anyway, the GPAI is an initiative that's being built. And the experts are a bunch of academics, by and large, who aren't used to watching government happen. And so it's been a really interesting experience, especially as someone who just came from a computer science department into a governance and policy school, to watch the institution being formed and to see that we can have efficacy not only about artificial intelligence, but about like how our nation's talking to each other about artificial intelligence.
So maybe you can give us a little insight what you're currently working on.
We've announced a few projects which are pretty exciting about, some of them are sort of the AI for good, like, you know, injecting artificial intelligence, because we're working with transnational governments, into projects that maybe commercial entities wouldn't have done on their own. In fact, I'm the co-chair of the AI governance committee. And so we're really, really interested in this bigger questions about how we deal with things transnationally, you know, which companies are at the table, all those kinds of questions. And so the first big project that we're involved in is actually about social media. How do you regulate and govern social media? And in fact, our colleagues in New Zealand are taking the lead on that.
I would like to talk about how we could use AI for public welfare. It leads us also to your most recently published article.
That is such a large question. And I think it has lots of answers. Some people are saying that artificial intelligence is sort of the new electricity. And I think that's kind of true in a way. It changes everything we do. And so basically all the ways in which we can govern, everything that involves sort of planning and searching and knowing more things, AI will alter. So that changes just fundamental communication, right? But then, of course, we are able to communicate. And of course, the arts have been trying to do this for a while, but maybe we can communicate even more effectively, for example, our impacts on the planet, and help people come to democratic consensus around really big issues.
If AI is helping us to communicate more effectively, how can it help in the field of polarization under rising economic decline and inequalities?
I think that's, to me, one of the most fascinating questions. My most recent big science paper was about the fact that political polarization is highly correlated with inequality, wealth inequality, but not perfectly correlated with wealth inequality. And we wanted to know why. And actually, Germany and China are two countries that have relatively high inequality, but relatively low political polarization. than you would expect relative to their level of inequality. And so what our model showed was that it isn't the inequality itself that's the problem. It's whether people are under threat because they're slipping down a slope, and if they slip too far, they fall off a cliff. If you are under that kind of a threat, and if things are getting harder and harder, then it might make sense to take smaller and smaller risks, even if by taking a smaller risk, you have a less good chance of a big positive upside.
So what exactly does that mean when we stick to the picture of a cliff?
It's right while you're by the cliff. You don't want to fall down the cliff. So even if you could have been moved way back up the hill, you're like, yeah, but I can't afford to fall off the cliff. So you have to take littler steps. And so we think that's when polarization happens. It isn't just that you're restricting yourself to people you really well understand. It's that you're investing a huge amount in aligning with one group of people. And so, and with the co-authors that I wrote it with are actually working on some refinements of the model. But I think it's more important, and especially in the context of Hardy School, it's a great place to do this, to go out and see if we're right.
So I want to talk to you about the ethical standards and principles, because over the years, you have watched how this evolved. And in 2010, you also co-authored the UK Research Innovation Principle of Robotics. So the country's first national level AI ethics policy. But there are different regulations in the European Union about this, and there are more to come. But what about the limits?
So that's a really interesting question, too. And again, I've learned so much about that in the recent years. So a lot of people were talking about ethics. I mean, really, it's hard to believe. Yeah. You mentioned that that British Principles of Robotics, that was the first national level soft law, as they call it. But, you know, we were basically fighting Asimov's laws, you know, back to the science fiction. Everybody thought, oh, there's no problem with ethics because science fiction has solved this. Even though if you actually read the science fiction, it's all about how those laws don't work. But nevertheless, people thought that. Now, in the last 4 or 5 years, people have said, what are you even talking about? Why are you talking about ethics? There's this stuff called human rights, which is actually in the law, right? And so now we start to realize that when corporations talk too much about ethics, they're saying, don't tie us down legally. We want to be free to do what we want to do, and we just have to make some claims and hire some philosophers.
Well, this is a challenging problem, but out of your perspective, what could be a solution?
I'm working on a book now. I've been thinking a lot about ethics. Again, if you want to go to a very basic definition of ethics, it's all the means by which we hold our societies together. And so that's one of the challenges of the digital era, is that we can rapidly create new societies at different scales. And that kind of, again, challenges governance, especially governments. But because there are still the physical concerns about where we are actually situated. So we will always have governments. But what they do is a little different when all of a sudden you can have these other emergent societies that people can exploit the pressures of polarization to make it very difficult to do governing.
And as you are in so many research groups and projects and working also interdisciplinary, what are the next plans here?
A lot of what I've done since I've come to Hardy, and again, this has only been a year, I created a new collaboration thanks to some colleagues who invited me to give a talk in Munich back in February of 2020, before everything came down. And so together, we've been working on several different projects looking at people trying to interfere with the regulatory process in various ways. And I had originally thought, because I'm a geek and a scientist, that people just didn't understand AI. And now I'm starting to see the extent to which some people either deliberately or just, you know, some kind of implicit, it helps them, that they're pushing their understanding in a way to evade regulation. And they're trying to push the EU's understanding in a way to evade regulation.
Yeah, for their own benefit.
And one of the nice things is I don't have nearly as much money, but I'm just speaking very simple truths. And so when you get to give a talk, if you get a chance at the table, people are seeing things. And so I feel like, it's not perfect and nothing is perfect and we all need to keep working. But the e-regulations that have been coming around, the Digital Service Act, the Digital Markets Act, the new AI regulation, that all of these things taken together are handling the kinds of problems I've been talking to you about.
One question to the daily use of AI technology, because we do use it day by day, doesn't matter if it's on our smartphone, smart home, Harper's makers, whatsoever. Why are there so many negative voices if it is already such a firm component of all of our lives?
Well, I do feel that it's changed. There was, again, 5 or 10 years ago, people said, you're just wrong. We don't know what AI is, but we know it when we see it. You know, it has glowing red eyes and. But I think really, I guess the 2016, the Brexit and the American election was kind of a wake up. People saw like, oh, this is a different kind of Skynet. And they understood that there might be something else going on that they should worry about too. And I'm hoping that the message is getting out. Although these things come in waves, you know, and so there are still huge numbers of people who think that there really are now robot citizens, that AI is doing all these things, that AI is, you know, on Mars twittering at them or whatever. So there is still a level of, we call that anthropomorphism, this belief that what it is to be intelligent is to be human, that we talked about way back at the beginning of the interview here, about that if you are intelligent, you must be human-like, mm-hmm. right? And so there are definitely still some people that have that. But to me, the important thing I shouldn't say that. They're definitely in a democracy, it's important what most people think. But it's also been very important to just educate the elite about, the fact that artificial intelligence is software.
I wanted to ask you, how do you view the AI's prospects in Germany in comparison to the previous countries you worked in or just you keep an eye on all the time?
Oh, they're so different. I have a paper in press actually that shows that in terms of both market capitalization and IP, the United States is still outstripping the entire rest of the world. Now, the reason that we did that paper was because people were saying that there's only two powers, China and America. And actually, even if you just look at those two measures, which are weird measures, the EU isn't that far behind China, as people say. It's and actually, where we're further behind is market capitalization, but is that behind? Again, you have to say, do you want to have these national champions with so much power, quote unquote national champions, but these companies with so much power that they can't be governed, right? Mm-hmm. So maybe that's actually a regulatory strategy, not a weakness of our markets. So what you have is this AI pervading these small, medium size enterprises. I mean, Austria and Greece are countries that have reinvented their economies around the digital. It's incredible. And you can't do that without AI. So we definitely have a lot of AI here. Also, a whole lot of the people making unbelievable large amounts of money in America are Europeans. It's European talent, European education, but they've just chosen to go on this gold rush. And not all the talent is there. There is quite a lot of talent, including Americans like myself, who said, no, we like living in a well-regulated society that's more fair. And you know, there's higher social mobility here. The basic ideas of fairness are stronger here. So I think right now the EU is in a really good situation for leading.
What about the state of affairs in Germany? How far is our technical situation compared to the other European leading countries? Well, of course, I know we are far behind when it comes to digitalization.
Germany
but
is amazing. It is so interesting. And it's because of the history, the older history, going back to like 1918 of the labor movement. So there's this ministry. First of all, it's the ministry of not just of labor, but of labor and society. That's one of the three ministries in charge of AI policy here. So you have, this is normal. A lot of people put AI in their economic ministry and the education ministry. That's a bit unusual. But I think absolutely uniquely, it's the third one is the labor and society. And then the Ministry of Labor and Society is in charge of product safety. So they're actually bringing all these things to the GPA table and they're seeing how it works. And so at that level, they're great. On the other hand, they obviously, and again, for good reasons and from a recent history, but they are really behind in the digital, that there's been some, I know like I should go to Africa or somewhere where things are really different, but it's such a different context in terms of some ways that it's so far advanced over what I've seen in America and the US in some kinds of thinking. And then other kinds of ways, it's just like, whoa, I didn't see this as a consequence. And is it a consequence or is it just a parochialism? You know, I don't know. I'm still learning.
Systems are completely different and you've only been here for a year. So one of my last questions, what do we have to expect in future? What about the status quo in AI in year 2040 or 2050? What would you prognosticate?
Yeah, that's really hard to say. I think we're simultaneously in three crises, right? We've got the pandemic, we've got this crisis of digital governance where we're not really sure how well we can defend, although, you know, the American election looked pretty good, but it was a lot of work. And then we have, of course, I just think really underestimated, not just the climate crisis, but the sustainability crisis. So I'm personally very worried about things like insectageddon, you know, and the amount of plastics that's building up in the environment and poison and things like that. But I feel like if we project into like 40 or 50 years into the future, that artificial intelligence is going to be kind of as invisible as electricity. And to some extent, that has been the problem. Part of the problem of polarization is that we used to think that the job of government, as I said, was to create this stable platform and kind of stay out of the way, that people didn't need to see it all the time. But then people don't understand why they're investing resources in it. So somehow, now that we have all this more intelligence out there and this this capacity for lifelong learning, I told you I'm thinking about research projects. This is my sort of 5 to 7 year research project I've been thinking of is. But it's about not only helping companies to be transparently complying with regulations, but also helping people to be able to assure themselves about what is information versus misinformation. First of all, how can you find what you need? I can't even find things in my own records, right? You know, and I have an AI PhD, right? So real transparency isn't just about dumping information. It's about investing effort in constructing a capacity for that information to be understood, right? But then secondly, why do people not believe the truth when it's right in front of them? And so that involves, I think, not only education, although I do think that parts of the problem have been this teach to test, the elimination, people trying to eliminate chance and eliminating the highs as well as the lows. So there has been some mistakes probably made in education. Yes. And I'm worried also about the pandemic in this. You need to really know a bunch of people. You grow up at school, you have a bunch of people that you know who you can trust. You were playing with them on the playground, you know, who would occasionally backstab, who was always lying, who was like always there for you, right? And then you also, they all get different jobs and you can call one of them up if you're trying to believe, you know, some medical information, call somebody else up if you're trying to understand what's going on in big tech. You need to have friends that you trust that have somebody else they trust, and that it can't be too many steps like that. And so I think there are standards that we can develop, and that's probably where I'm more in a better position to help technologically about trying to communicate information. But we also need to be thinking about the big picture again, one of the other big projects is transnational taxation for the transnational corporations. So making sure the money is there so that people aren't falling behind. They don't have to have that fear of falling off the cliff.
Yeah, that's actually a wonderful picture that we had in our conversation of the cliff and the comparison to the threat. People are falling down or falling behind in the society. Yeah, and it's really important, as you said, that they have the time to learn and to develop and to understand things. There could be so many other things we could talk about, because there's so much various impacts that AI has on our society, on our economical system and welfare system, and also the future of work. So I don't know if we just quickly talk about the future of work.
Yeah, I have two minds about the future of work. It may be that more and more people won't be able to fit in. Like right now, if you're not literate, it's very hard for you to entirely fit in. And there's some people that just biologically are not capable of reading. It's not just about education. You know, there's problems. But it may be that we're going to create more of that. But then another side of me thinks, no, most of what people are about is each other. And so I think for a lot of people, life won't be that different. Except that, you know, like we can already Google things, that we have video all the time, and it's, you know, AI is making your pictures look better. You may think that you've gotten better as a photographer, and maybe you have some, but a lot of that is the AI. So if we're going to be sustainable, if we're going to hold things together, then we've got to create this very rich tapestry of social life again. Otherwise, we can be exploited and set against each other. I mean, imagine if you could have a search engine that told you what would be the best thing for you to do with your life. And that, not necessarily, of course, it can certainly produce the future, but it could give you a probability distribution over, like, which of the courses should I take? And you know, knowing that there's something smarter than you that could make the words come out better or whatever. So I think...
But truly get addicted, right?
Well, it could be addicted, but it could also make you feel valueless. And so I think the value, our value comes from each other. And so we need to help make sure that people continue to have cultural identities and continue to find ways to support each other.
And again, wonderful closing lines from Joanna Bryson. Thank you so much. It was a pleasure to talk to you.
And thank you. I really enjoyed it. It's people don't usually stitch all those pieces together that way. So that was really fun.
Ihr wollt mehr spannende Geschichten rund um die Hertie-Stiftung hören? Dann abonniert doch unseren Podcast-Channel Hertie Interviews auf Spotify und Apple Podcasts. Und wenn ihr mögt, lasst uns eine Bewertung da. Weitere Interviews, Videos und Beiträge findet ihr auch auf ghst.de.